Turn your tax refund into a new garage door at Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Increase your home's value with a new Ideal garage door. From traditional to modern, Menards has a garage door to enhance your home's appearance. Choose from our large in-stock selection or design your own using our free garage door design program. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Hello and welcome to the weekend podcast of Lotus Eaters. I'm here with Josh today and we're going to be talking about learned helplessness. So I've already read a little bit about it, so I don't know the details, but Josh is going to tell us all about the details.
So. I am indeed. So in this first part, I'm going to talk about what learned helplessness theory is and how we've come to discover what it is and the experiments surrounding it. And then in the second part, I'm going to talk about the neuroscience of it, and I'm also going to talk about how it applies to human beings.
All right.
And I'll just start off with a definition. So before we dive into the actual research of it, we have an idea of what it actually is. So learned helplessness is a mental state in which an organism is forced to tolerate adverse stimuli, mm-hmm. so things that are negative in its environment. So stimuli that are painful or otherwise unpleasant, and become unable or unwilling to avoid subsequent encounters with those stimuli, even if they are escapable, presumably because they learn that they cannot control the situation. And this concept, as you can see, it's talking about animals, mm-hmm. and it uses that kind of language, and that comes from its roots in animal psychology, but it has been found to translate to human beings. In regards to human beings, it's a little bit more to do with perception, mm-hmm. and it is about how people feel that they have no control over their situation and behave in a helpless manner, and this inaction can lead people to overlook opportunities which otherwise would change their situation and make it better. And
right. So the difference that you just made between the case in animals and with humans is, sure. that does that have to do anything with how people think about things, or what's the difference between how this affects animals and this affects humans?
Well, human beings are conscious and animals are not. That's the main distinction there, in that human beings can perceive something as being negative, and it can have as much of an effect on their kind of physiology as a physically negative thing. So like there's evidence that emotional pain can cause just as much trauma to people as physical pain.
Right, I see.
And it's not so much the case for animals, because they don't have as much of a kind of wealth of mental life. If that's a really right. bad way of putting yeah. it, but like...
No. I mean, I understand what you're saying, that like there is a larger scope in humans for this phenomenon to happen, just because we can perceive something non-physically harmful as harmful anyway.
Exactly, yeah. And so this study kind of has its roots in behaviorism, which largely focused on the study of animals, and you'll be familiar with research of Skinner looking at association between rats, and Pavlov, who I'll get into in a second, with dogs. And so essentially all of this started in the early 60s, when a psychologist known as Richard Solomon and his students at the University of Pennsylvania wanted to look into how prior Pavlovian fear conditioning would influence later instrumental learning. Mm-hmm. And there are quite a few terms yeah. there yeah, that people aren't going to be familiar with, which is understandable. So I'll start with the Pavlovian fear conditioning part of it. Mm-hmm. So Ivan Pavlov, who gives his name to Pavlovian conditioning, was a Russian physiologist from kind of the 1890s, who is, you know, a famous name in psychology that probably even people who haven't studied it are very familiar with. And he discovered that dogs in his lab learnt to associate ringing a bell to be associated with food. And this happened over the course of repeated exposures. So the bell would be rung and then their food would be brought out, and eventually they became able to associate the ringing of the bell with food, even if the food wasn't coming. And they were able to tell this because the dogs started to salivate in mm-hmm. anticipation of the food before it had actually been brought out, because they associated it with the ringing of the bell. And that's where that term comes from. So that's the Pavlovian conditioning part. And they also mention instrumental learning, which is another form of conditioning, which is where the consequences of a response determines the probability of it being repeated. And it's known as operant conditioning or instrumental learning. And that is where conditioned behavior is often reinforced or rewarded, and therefore it will be likely repeated in the future. Mm-hmm. So it's about positive and negative responses to behavior, as right. opposed to having two unassociated stimuli occurring at once and then associations being formed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So this is how animal behavior is essentially influenced through these two avenues. You have the one where they build associations with things, and then you have the one where they have certain behaviors reinforced either positively or negatively depending on the consequences.
Right, I see. Mm-hmm.
So that was the kind of behaviorist view in the 1960s of animal and therefore also human behavior.
Wait, so how have we moved from 1890s to 1960s? Like nothing was happening in the meantime?
Not really in animal psychology, like the basis for this research. So
okay.
There's obviously lots of stuff in between where it's not so relevant, and quite a lot of the time you find that it's to do simply with the funding. In kind of the 60s, there was lots of funding for science, mm-hmm. and people were looking back in the past and coming up with studies based on research from a very long time ago, whereas in contemporary science, it's like seen as kind of old-timey if you go to the 80s.
Right.
So,
so there was kind of a revival of psychology after half a century of being dormant.
And that is in part due to the kind of behaviorism from the start of the early 20th century mm-hmm. and these findings, and it kind of slowly gained exponential popularity. And right. it's also by the 60s, psychology was kind of captivating public interest a lot more, and it was viewed as more legitimate, which it was compared to the past of, you know, the psychoanalytic approach. Books. And well, he was actually a physiologist. He wasn't even a psychologist. But anyway, I'll get onto a quote, which is actually from the person who coined the term learned helplessness, and mm-hmm. they're summarizing the experiment that was conducted by Solomon, and I feel like they did a good job of doing that. So they say, to find out essentially how this Pavlovian fear conditioning would influence later instrumental or operant mm-hmm. conditioning, they restrained dogs in hammocks, and the dogs got 64 mild to moderate electric shocks. Oof. So yeah, that's pretty awful. I would really like to clarify that this is not something that would ever pass an ethics board anymore. So I know there's a perception that psychologists are all evil, and although I am one and I have a vested interest in that not being the case, people neither have the appetite nor the ability to do research like this. It's you kind of go back from about 1970 backwards, and there's some really unethical research. There's horrendous stuff like the Milgram shock experiment, where yep. he got people to believe they were shocking people, and you've
at
got
at least nobody actually got shocked.
Yeah, that's true, but they went away and believed it, and people had to actually get like therapy afterwards.
Yeah
So it's obviously bad. And you got the Zimbardo prison study, where you got loads of college kids in and told them to take roles as prisoners and prison guards, and then all of a sudden they started essentially abusing the prisoners, and supposedly people had to quit out and people had mental breakdowns and stuff like that, and it's all very unethical, and that's not the case anymore. Like,
but those are the famous ones though.
I know there's obviously lots
I'm
more
not
than
advocating
that.
For like unethical things either, but just pointing out historical facts.
And these historical studies are quite useful to the modern day because we can't do this kind of research anymore for obvious reasons.
I mean, you wouldn't want to. That's the thing.
I definitely wouldn't. Exactly. I really like dogs, and I definitely wouldn't want to use my psychological knowledge to electrocute them. It seems awful. And in the later study, the follow-up to this one, which this entire theory is based, one of the dogs actually died in the electric shock stage, which is awful. So this has come at a cost, this knowledge. But anyway, I'll carry on with what I was saying. So essentially, they got these mild to moderate electric shocks on their back paws, and each shock came with a tone or a noise. Mm-hmm. And 24 hours later, the dogs were placed in a shuttle box, which is just like a thing with a closing door. And they're supposed to learn to escape the shock by jumping a short barrier between two chambers. And essentially, what they found was that dogs who had been electrocuted and they could not escape, they were in like a harness, they learnt, or, well, they didn't know that at the time, but they had learnt that they couldn't do anything to help that situation, therefore they accepted being helpless and did nothing. Whereas if you put a naive dog that hadn't had this electrocution like training, which sounds awful,
conditioning,
if they hadn't had that, they would just escape immediately. And it was kind of going against the classical and operant conditioning views, because neither of those could explain this well. Surely they have this negative stimulus and they would escape it. That's what the behaviorist view would have assumed, but it turns out that they didn't do that. And this is what led Seligman and Meyer to carry out some research following this in 1967. Essentially carried out a similar study and just tried to figure out why it would be. So they essentially put the dogs into the same situation where they had unavoidable electric shocks, and they again failed to take action in like the subsequent situation, even where the possibility of escape was possible. The ones that learnt that they couldn't do anything would still not attempt to do that. Whereas the dogs that were not electrocuted escaped immediately.
So was that just a repetition of the previous experiment?
Yeah, more or less, but they essentially repeated it both to kind of verify the findings. Obviously, it's when you have research that combats the prevailing theories at the time, the kind of scientific intuition is to say, okay, well, something weird is going on here, but it might not necessarily be repeatable. It could just be an anomaly. So they wanted to repeat it, but also they were interested in looking at why it actually happens. Like, the original study was just unintentional, whereas this
noticed,
one...
noticed,
exactly.
And so did they actually come up with an explanation of why? Or
yes,
or,
they did.
Yes, so you just... you described why already in the first kind of in the first experiment, even though they had not thought about it that much.
Of course, yeah. Right. So anyway, they theorized that animals learnt that outcomes were independent of their responses, that nothing they did mattered, and that this learning undermined trying to escape. The experiment was replicated with human subjects as well later on. This was in 75, I think. The original replication was in 67, and that used loud noises as opposed to electric shocks, because ethics had moved on a bit then, and they couldn't electrocute human beings. That's funny, that. I mean,
progress.
Yeah, but I would like to take like an aside and just say that most psychology in the modern day is very ethical. No one gets harmed. Like, you have to go through a really long, drawn-out ethical review process where you have to justify every element of your experiment. And I've done this a couple of times, and it's such a headache, because I had a really mundane experiment where no one could be harmed. It was just inputs on a computer, and I had to do a back and forth with the ethics committee several times, just explaining stuff so they're completely clear about my rationale and the theory and the like the benefits to science for me doing that.
Yeah. And so it wasn't just about like risks. So you couldn't say, you couldn't say I'm not sure about the scientific benefit, but there's no risks. Like that wouldn't.
Yeah, you've got to have a reason to do it. Otherwise, you're just wasting people's time taking part. Essentially,
you're paying them, right?
Well, I wasn't.
I guess someone's sponsoring you, so they want to know what you're doing.
But a lot of psychologists nowadays would condemn the prior unethical behaviour of those past psychologists. And I'd also like to say that a lot of psychologists are not social justice types. I've seen lots of comments where they're saying our psychology is just pseudoscience, but there are plenty of biological psychologists and cognitive psychologists that are doing great work that's really uncontroversial. And like, you can't say that people studying the optics of, you know, human vision, that's not pseudoscience. I mean, they're doing something valid. And there's more to it than the stuff that the average person gets exposed to.
Yeah, but I think those allegations might be overstated.
But I obviously have a vested interest in defending my discipline, so you don't necessarily have to take my word for it.
Sus.
But one of the responses to their research, because obviously the behaviourist view, which this research went against, was dominant at the time, and one of the behaviourists said, "You are proposing that animals learn that responding is ineffective. Animals learn responses, they don't learn that anything." So they're saying they don't learn consequences, they build associations. Mm-hmm. Because if an animal was making a prediction of the future, then there's got to be some degree of self-awareness there.
Right.
And that's the point they're making, which sounds perfectly reasonable, but it seems like there is some limited capacity for learning.
Right. So are they saying basically that them running away from the place where they get electric shocks is the same thing as them salivating?
Well, I think what they're trying to say is that their conclusions are wrong, but they're not necessarily disputing that the procedure and what they've observed is incorrect. Right. So that they're targeting that interpretation rather than necessarily what happened.
So it's just targeting that specific point that the dogs are not doing it on purpose, because they're not thinking about it. It's just like that's what they do because that's the reflex that they
built. It's there was a kind of a model and an understanding of behavior where all animal behavior was just a response to stimuli. Mm-hmm. And it was automatic, what we would describe as unconscious, and that there was no actual thought processing, but this ran counter to that view. Of course, we know this to be the case in the modern day because we know that other non-human primates can use tools and things like that, which obviously shows that they've got some capacity to learn. And with dogs, obviously, they're mammals, so they're not too far from that kind of scope of being able to learn stuff. And I mean, it shouldn't really come as much of a surprise because dogs can learn things just when you keep them as a pet, obviously. You've still got the association with like teaching them to do tricks with treats. That's still following the behaviorist conditioning approach, but they can kind of predict future behavior.
Yep.
And I'm sure people can anecdotally verify that.
Okay. So,
essentially the mechanism of learned helplessness is that you are put in a situation where you can't do anything to help yourself, and you learn you can't do anything, and therefore you don't take any future action. However, more recent biological evidence has suggested that it's actually the other way around, and that passivity in response to shock is not learned, it's actually the default, and we learn to get away from it as opposed to the other.
So that's specific to humans, right, and not animals, or is it like more generally?
It's more generally. So that's just how it seems to work.
Okay.
So
we'll save that for tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay.